Good morning, Neighborhood Church. If you want to keep your Bibles open to Mark 15 there, we'll be spending our time in this passage. I know it's not technically Good Friday yet, and we have a couple of services later this week, Monday, Thursday, and Good Friday. But since we're working through the Gospel of Mark, and just in general, it's customary in the week leading up to Easter to really make sure that we know the background and the foundation and the assumptions behind the Easter story. This is going to be kind of our Good Friday sermon where we look at the crucifixion in Mark 15. And again, just acknowledge Sunday, it's not Friday, but every year we come to this part of the year, I find it helpful to step back and just think about, just ponder the strangeness of Christians calling this day good. Good Friday, a day when Jesus is tortured, a day when Jesus is mocked and humiliated and spit upon, a day in which he is rejected by both the people of Israel and the Roman and Gentile world around him, when he is abandoned, even seemingly by God. Psalm 22, which we read out loud, is actually quoted multiple times in Mark 15, explicitly by Jesus on the cross right before he dies and says, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" But even many of the hostile bystanders who walk by, the language on their lips is the language of Psalm 22. He delights in God, let him deliver him. Psalm 22 saturates this passage. And of course, ultimately, what is the great tragedy, the great ruin, the ultimate evil, I think ultimately experientially as well as biblically we believe this in the world, the Apostle Paul will later say in 1 Corinthians 15, the last enemy that stands opposed to us is death. That this is the moment Jesus dies, when he gives up the Spirit of God, the breath of God, he breathes his last and he dies, seemingly forsaken by God, certainly forsaken by his friends, and by his enemies, by Israel, and by the Gentiles, utterly alone. And yet Christians want to call this moment good. And just want to acknowledge the strangeness of that. And that kind of sets up what I hope we'll do. In the bulletin, maybe you've already noticed, I put a quote that's maybe a little edgier than I would usually put in here. If you want to look at the beginning of your bulletin, I put in a quote, I included a quote by Martin Buber, who was not only a brilliant Jewish theologian of the 20th century, but also a very famous philosopher. Some of you maybe heard of or even read some of I and Thou. He was a famous German Jewish existentialist philosopher, brilliant, brilliant man. And as many Jewish thinkers and Jewish theologians often have had throughout history, he had a lot of admiration for Jesus. He saw a lot of incredible teaching from Jesus, but ultimately he did not think that Jesus was the Messiah. He did not think that he was the King of Israel. And in his book, Israel and the World, in these couple of sentences, I think Martin Buber gets to the heart better than any single kind of summary I've ever seen of what the controversy is, not just between Jews and Christians, but really just belief and unbelief in general, whether it's a Jew or a Gentile, of looking at this moment. And many of you know this, that virtually everyone agrees, even the most secular critical historians agree that one, Jesus was a real human being. Almost no one will argue that Jesus is made up historically. That's a very fringe position historically that no respectable historian would argue. And almost all historians also believe that Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. That those facts are as established apart from faith as they can be, and no one really calls into question. What is called into question is whether this moment is what Christians historically claim it is. Of course, the resurrection 3 days later, tons of debate over that, whether everything that happens in the Gospels before this moment, whether the miracles happen, plenty of people debate that, but everyone agrees this man lived and this man died this way under the Roman Empire, and the claim of Christianity is that this is Good Friday. And Martin Buber says this to the Christian, the Jewish person, and what he means by here is ethnically Jewish, religiously Jewish, but doesn't believe Jesus is Messiah. To the Christian, the Jew is the incomprehensibly obdurate or stubborn man who declines, who refuses to see what has happened. That's how Christians often look at Jews. Think of how often you might think, man, like look at Isaiah 53, look at the Old Testament. How can you not see that Jesus is the Messiah? There's often this sense of like, how do you not see this? But Buber says, on the other hand, but to the Jew, the Christian is the incomprehensibly daring man who affirms that in an unredeemed world, that is, redemption has been accomplished. This is a gulf which no human power can bridge. What Buber is saying is nothing has changed since this moment happened in the world. Sin, death, idolatry, oppression, injustice, BC, AD, there is no shift in human history from before to after this moment. And if he was the Messiah, the world would have been changed. And I think that's a great both challenge for us to think through, but also a great guiding way to think about what exactly are Christians claiming when they say that this Friday is Good Friday. And so one simple way to think about this will kind of guide our look at Mark 15 this morning. So that's the question. What exactly did the cross accomplish? What happened in this moment? What did this experience do in the world? Not just what happened to Jesus, but what came about according to the early Christians by this? And for many of us, we probably, when we ask that question, if we do, we immediately kind of shuffle our Bible over to the Apostle Paul or to Peter, because they're the ones who later on, we read in 1 Peter 2, who begin giving us metaphors, who begin giving us theories, if you want to use that language, for what happened here. And the reality is that theories are, on the one hand, both essential, but they are also secondary and ultimately insufficient if they become disconnected from the original data, the original evidence that gave rise to them. For instance, imagine if, and some of us did this in high school, you're supposed to read a classic book and you don't read it at all. And instead you either watch the movie or you read the Cliff Notes version, or worse, you read like a theoretical summary of it online that's in abstract language. Imagine never reading Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings, but reading a theory about what the story is about. If you only had access to theories that claim this is what the story is about, but you don't actually read the story, you actually wouldn't really understand what the theories are saying, nor would they have the power that they're supposed to have in your life. There is a role for, oh, now that I know who Aragorn or Harry and Ron and Hermione are, now I'm reading somebody reflecting on it later on and I understand even more about the story that I already read. But the theories are not a substitute for the story. And one of the things I'm excited about that we're in Mark is you could read Mark 15, not just once, but maybe dozens of times, and come away still thinking, like, I don't really know what Mark thinks happened here. Because you just have human characters who are saying stuff, and you have, you know, historical events portrayed. But what exactly did this moment do? What did it accomplish? And what we're going to do in the time we have left is I want to give four very typical, mainstream, I think all important, all foundational theories that Christians have about the cross. And I'll talk about this in a second. I think all of them are true. It's not this one's right and the other three are wrong, that the cross is inexhaustible in its significance. What Jesus accomplished in his death, 1 Peter, we didn't read this passage, but 1 Peter says angels long to look into the gospel because they're constantly noticing new things about it because it connects to everything. And so even what we look at today is just a small snippet at best of what really happened on the cross. But in general, one of the most typical mistakes many Christians make is to take their favorite theory of the cross, it's this, and they use it to say, and therefore the other theories are wrong. This is what happened on the cross, not that, but that's almost always a mistake. It's usually, this is one helpful way to look at the cross. This is another helpful paradigm to think about what happened there. This also truly describes what God was doing in Christ to reconcile the world to himself, as the Apostle Paul will say later on in 2 Corinthians 5, that there are different ways of looking at one reality from different perspectives. But what I want us to do mostly is look at it through the lens of the narrative, look at it through the lens of the story. And so for each of the four theories or models or metaphors we're going to look at, for what Christians claim happened on this day 2,000 years ago, is we're going to look at it through the eyes of the character. So we're going to look at the cross through the eyes of Pontius Pilate first. We're going to look at the cross through the eyes of Barabbas. Maybe you noticed him. He's not as well known, but he's a very striking character in this story. We're going to look at the cross through the lens of, in the eyes of Simon of Cyrene. And two of his sons are mentioned here, Alexander and Rufus. And I don't know if you have ever kind of puzzled at this with me, but like, why are his kids mentioned? And we'll talk about that. And then we're going to look at it through the lens of the centurion, who notices and watches how Jesus dies at the end and is kind of the culmination. And we're going to, through their eyes, hopefully get a sense of what Mark thinks is actually going on here. And so here is the first one. And again, these are complementary, not contradictory ways to look at the cross. And I'll, at the very end, I'll give one or two thoughts on how we might understand them to work together. But the first way of thinking about the cross, and I would argue in some ways, this might be the overarching biggest category for the cross in the New Testament, is it's what the early church often called Christus Victor, Christ the Victor, that on the cross, Jesus is victorious over the power of sin and death and Satan, that this is the moment when Jesus is actually enthroned as Lord over all, when at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, we're not in Matthew, but at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, after his resurrection, Jesus will say, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, therefore go and proclaim the gospel to all the nations." And before that, Jesus decidedly did not have all authority in heaven and on earth. And he was constantly saying, don't go to the Gentiles yet. Don't go to the nations yet, because it's not time for it. And throughout both the Gospels and the rest of the New Testament, this is the moment, as Paul says in Romans 14, that Jesus became Lord, that he was exalted to and enthroned upon the role that both human beings in general were supposed to be playing in the universe in Genesis 1, having dominion over all of creation under God, but also the Davidic king, the Messiah, the king of Israel was always supposed to have, ruling over the nations on God's behalf, that this is that moment. I want you to notice, it's very easy to miss, looking at Pontius Pilate specifically. Look at verse 2 of chapter 15. Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Did you notice, as Kirk read this out loud, that phrase, that expression, king of the Jews, is the most repeated phrase in this entire chapter by far? There's verse 2. Look at verse 9. And he answered them, saying, "Do you want me to release for you the king of the Jews?" Verse 12, just a little while longer down, and Pilate again said to them, "Then what shall I do with the man you call the king of the Jews?" Verse 18, and they began to salute him. This is the soldiers. We'll look at them in just a moment, mocking Jesus with this kind of ironic coronation. "Hail, king of the Jews." Verse 26, the inscription of the charge above the cross as he's crucified reads, "The king of the Jews." Some of you will remember, must be at least 2 months ago now, when we were in Mark 10, one of the many passion predictions that Jesus makes about his death that is then immediately followed, one, by a misunderstanding of the disciples, and then two, by Jesus teaching them about discipleship, was Jesus predicts that this is going to happen earlier in his ministry, and James and John begin arguing over which of them is the greatest and asking Jesus that they can sit at his right in his left hand when he becomes king. And back then, even months ago, we looked at this, but notice verse 26, Jesus is crucified. The Gospel of John will literally say, lifted up and exalted on the cross, literally, physically, but then also metaphorically, he's becoming king in this moment. And the charge says the king of the Jews. And in verse 27, and with Jesus, they crucified two robbers, one on his right and one on his left. This is Jesus's enthronement. This is Jesus entering into his glory. This is Jesus becoming exactly what everybody keeps calling him, but none of them actually believe he is, the king of the Jews. And then finally, in verse 32, it says, the mockers, the passerbys say, "Let the Christ, the king of Israel, the Messiah, the king of the Jews, come down now from the cross that we may see and believe." And again, I'm not going to read it again because Kirk has already read it, but it really is easy to miss, but so significant that in verses 16 through 20, when Pilate's soldiers disrobe Jesus, torture him, beat him to get him ready to be crucified, that they first engage in this very clear mockery of a coronation scene. They put a crown of thorns on his head, so he's bleeding. And they strip him naked, but then they put a purple robe on him, the color of royalty. They beat him with a stick, but they put it in his hand as if it's his scepter. And then they bow down to him and say, "Hail, King of the Jews." And we have seen repeatedly in this season that Mark loves to tell this story with irony. Irony in a sense of what's going on in the surface is not what's actually going on behind the scenes or vice versa. And this is one of the ultimate ironic moments. They are mocking Jesus because they think this is not what's happening, but the reader should know this is precisely what is happening in this moment. Jesus is being exalted as king. He is defeating all of the enemies of God, the power of sin, the curse of death, the reign of Satan are all being overthrown in this moment. That's the claim that Christians make, and they make it regularly in the rest of the New Testament and later on in the early church, that this is the moment when evil is defeated. One of the reasons I suspect that Martin Buber was tempted to or concluded that, you know, you guys say that this is this big moment, but it's really not anything, is that many of us as Christians, we often do reduce, I think, the significance of Good Friday to something that's just private for me, something that's individual for a couple of us who happen to believe, something that's compartmentalized, like, you know, unlike the rest of our life, here's Jesus saving our souls, or here's kind of like the religious part of the life that Jesus is cleansing through his death on the cross. But for the early church, this is the ultimate answer to the problem of evil. Now, it doesn't, and this is part of what Buber is saying, it doesn't end evil here, but it is that there was a famous analogy that a 20th century theologian used named Oscar Kuhlmann. He was German, but he also lived in the World War II era. And he said the death of Jesus is like D-Day during World War II. And when Jesus comes again in the future, that's like VE Day, Victory in Europe Day. That if you were paying attention during World War II, you knew that once the German forces were broken on the Normandy beaches, it was only a matter of time till this thing was over. But there were still skirmishes happening. There was still resistance, but you knew the tide of the war had turned. And that's what Good Friday is. That sin and death and Satan, they're still around in the universe, but they are decidedly on the retreat. They have been defeated. They have been evacuated of their power, and they are no longer the most powerful players on the scene. That now Jesus, through the Spirit in his death and resurrection, and eventually the church in the power of the Spirit following Jesus, are now more significant players in the world than sin and death and Satan are. That at least is the claim. I'm going to move on in a second, but since I always, not always, often try to work in something like this in this season, I have been talking a lot about how I've been rereading The Lord of the Rings in this season. I never noticed this before, but somebody posted it online, so I just have to share it, that apparently if you read the appendices in the back, which only the real nerds read, and I've never really read them, apparently Tolkien tells the entire story of the ring and the destruction of the ring according to the liturgical calendar of the church. And so at the beginning of the story, when they all get together in Rivendell and the Fellowship of the Ring gets together and they decide to invade Mordor to get rid of the ring, they leave Rivendell on December 25th. It's Christmas. That's the beginning of the invasion. And when Sauron falls, when Frodo and Sam sacrifice themselves, which themselves is very clearly, if not allegory, at least very similar to the self-sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, it's March 25th, which is Good Friday in the old church calendar. And so Sauron falls on Good Friday in The Lord of the Rings. And it's a reminder that through this act of sacrifice, Jesus was not just forgiving the sins of private individuals religiously, he was overcoming all the forces of darkness in the universe. In the future, we'll talk more about what does that mean, what does that look like, but through the eyes of Pilate, what we see is this guy doesn't look like he has any authority at all. This guy doesn't look like he is in charge of anything. This guy looks like sin and death and Satan are just taking a beating on him, and he can't do anything about it. And the soldiers, of course, themselves mock him with his coronation. But what Mark is depicting, which the rest of the early church, the Apostle Paul, Peter, John will describe, is this is the moment when sin was dethroned, when death was defeated, and when a human being who bears God's image was placed in charge of God's creation. And so in response to Martin Buber, and this itself is a claim of faith, which church history becomes a part of, but the claim of Mark, the claim of Matthew and Luke and John, the claim of every biblical writer is that what changed on Good Friday is that BC, sin, death, and Satan are the major players in the world. They are ruling the world. Even Israel under the old covenant, constantly hard of heart, and that's the norm in the world. Post-AD, the risen, crucified, ascended Jesus through the Spirit now rules the universe. That state of affairs actually switched in this moment in history. That actually took place in history when Jesus was crucified and raised from the dead, that all authority in heaven and on earth was given to him, and we now belong to him. I'm going to argue at the end that that's kind of the what. What did the cross accomplish? That it overcame all that had gone wrong in the world and restored a human being back to the role they were supposed to. We were supposed to be playing in Genesis 1. But the second question then becomes that's really interesting, but come on, like nothing has changed since, you know, this moment 2,000 years ago. How exactly do you think that happened? And this is where the motif is, and we'll look at this through Barabbas, that Jesus's death is not only a victory over evil, but it is also a sacrificial substitution for sinners. That if the first category is Christus Victor, Christ is victor, the second category is he's the sacrifice here. And of course, there are many other things that have set us up for this in the Gospel of Mark. Jesus just sat down with his disciples hours, no more than days before, at the Passover meal and said, "This is my body, this is my blood." He's been talking about the temple constantly. The temple veil is rent and torn as he's there. The way is opened up for sinners to access God. There's no longer a holy of holies that only a high priest can go into only once a year. We can all draw near to God all the time, and we are forgiven because of this moment. But I think this is beyond the fact that it happened. I don't think the gospel writers ever tell us things simply because they happened. I do think they happen, but they tell us things because they happened and they carry meaning that are still relevant for us today. And so if you wonder, like what's up with Barabbas here? You could argue, I suppose, that it just shows how awful we are as sinful human beings, that we would even choose Barabbas over Jesus. And certainly some of it's there, but I suspect that there's something a little more there, that Barabbas is very clearly described, right? Like you could find somebody who had stolen a car. You could find somebody who had, you know, beaten somebody up or even committed manslaughter, but you would still get the sense of, but you know, it's not the biggest travesty in the world that this guy got let go. But when Barabbas is let go, every single one of us as a reader is like, it's not just that Jesus doesn't deserve to die, it's that this guy does. This guy is a terrorist. This guy is a mass murderer. This is a guy who has committed, clearly it's implied, regular acts of violence and murder as a part of an insurrection, right? Like this is a guy who was not only in DC on January 6th and not only rushed the Capitol, this is the guy who killed one of the police officers on that day. This guy does not deserve to be released. And as we read about Barabbas, it's very, very easy to miss, but I want you to notice that in verse 12, Pilate very much expects that this is the way he's going to get off the hook, that of course you're going to want Jesus to go free instead of Barabbas, and he's stunned that they still choose Barabbas. And in verse 11, we're told, but the chief priests stirred up the crowd to have him release to them Barabbas instead. That little word instead is so significant. That what the cross is Jesus receiving instead what the Barabbases of the world are supposed to receive. But what is supposed to happen to us, the full consequences of sin, is death. It is being cut off from God, being cut off from life, instead falls upon this innocent man so that the Barabbases of the world can go free. That this is Isaac and Abraham in Genesis 22. Abraham thinks he needs to sacrifice his own son, but instead he learns that God has provided a ram instead of his son having to die, that this is a sacrifice of one person voluntarily in love, placing themselves in a position where, one, they experienced the consequences that were due to someone else so that that person could be freed from having to bear them, that this is the moment. What the entire sacrificial system in the Old Testament pointed to, what the temple was about, why forgiveness of sins can happen. This is the moment when all of these things come together. In the language of one of my favorite old hymns, and J.I. Packer actually wrote a whole book on the cross with this expression as a title, that in my place condemned he stood. Right? That's what the cross is. This is, we should have been like Barabbas, those who were in this position. We should have been those who died for our own crimes, but instead we are released as this man takes our place instead of us. And this is how Jesus overcomes sin. This is how he defeats death. This is how he ransoms and frees people from the power of Satan, from the power of darkness. That in Mark 10, verse 45, that for the third time in a passion prediction, the final time Jesus predicted his death, for the first time, he used this word, that the Son of Man has come not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. And that's a word that refers to both purchasing someone who is enslaved under something oppressive and who pays a price to do so. It doesn't say anything more than that. But here at the cross, we see that Jesus paid the price of his own life to set free and to forgive those who of their own volition had become slaves of sin and therefore under the dominion of death, that Jesus is the ultimate Passover lamb in this moment. And we see that, I think, through the eyes of Barabbas and the injustice and yet the beauty of this moment. Third, and this is the one that I think, especially for those of us who are Protestants and evangelicals, and we love substitutionary atonement, we love sacrifice, and rightly so, that maybe we can get our minds around Christus Victor, that the bigger picture is actually that sin and death and Satan were overthrown, not just that I as an individual was forgiven. But what we also see is that the cross is not just something that Jesus does in our place, even though that's true. It's also something that sets a pattern for us to follow and to imitate. That the cross is something that clarifies, crystallizes, focuses the way in which we are to imitate Christ. That is, the cross becomes a moral example of what love to God and love to neighbor looks like in a fallen world. And again, just want to remind us that every single time Jesus has talked about his coming death, his coming crucifixion in the Gospel of Mark, the very next thing he has mentioned without exception is, and you also must take up your cross and follow me. That the image there is not, I'm doing this so that you don't have to. The image there is, I'm doing this so that you come after me doing the same thing. And this I want us to see through the eyes of Simon of Cyrene. It's such an interesting little short vignette that this man who we have never met before, we never meet him again, apart from this short mention in the crucifixion scenes. We don't know if he knows Jesus. We don't know if he just is a random bystander who happens to be there. We don't know whether he's someone who's observant in Judaism or just a Gentile. We know so little about this man. And yet what we are told is two things. One is that he was enlisted to carry Jesus's cross with him. And I want to suggest that the image there is that Jesus carrying his cross or Jesus going to the cross is something that is to be participated in by others. It is something that includes us, that if Jesus, in the language of the Apostle Paul, dies for us, we are also called to die with him. If he suffers for us, the Apostle Paul regularly says, we are called to suffer with him in order that we might be glorified with him. And this is not a call to go out and get yourself martyred. This is not a call to go out and just look for suffering for its own sake. It's a way of reminding us that just as the story of Jesus has taught us, you can't really love God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind, and your neighbor as yourself in a fallen world without being willing to say yes to suffering and no to what you hope your own life will look like, because you are so often going to come to these forks in the road where it's either the purposes of God, the good of my neighbor, or what I would prefer the rest of the afternoon or the next year or the rest of my life to look like. And so this becomes the ultimate example of faithfulness to God. This becomes the ultimate pattern of the imitation of Christ, of what love for God, love for neighbor looks like. By the way, hard to prove one way or the other, but the vast majority of commentators, and I think they're right, argue that the reason Alexander and Rufus are mentioned here, even though we know nothing about Simon of Cyrene, is the only real reason that makes sense of that is because the early church at this point, you know, this is in the 60s or 70s at the latest when Mark writes this, that Alexander and Rufus have become Christians and they're part of the early church. That whether Simon was already a follower of Jesus is unclear here, but in response to this moment, they became followers of Jesus. And it's interesting, right? Like language about faith is good. It's important. Language about obedience is important. Language about discipleship is important. But we shouldn't miss or forget that the early church chose to use, among all the different images and ways of describing what it means to belong to Jesus, of following Jesus. Right? Like that's the image of what it means to be part of the people of God, that we follow Jesus. And at the beginning of the Gospels, that's always a very literal thing. Like Jesus is walking this way and you got to follow him if you want to stay connected to him. But they keep using that language. We are followers of Jesus. Because as Peter says in the passage Kirk read, this he not only died for us to bring the unrighteous to God, to put to death sin in order that we might live, all this sacrifice, all this victory over evil, he also set an example that we might follow in his footsteps. That's also what this moment is. And that also, and this is a much bigger claim, much bigger topic, we'll talk about this in the future, I would argue that insofar, to put it in a very simplistic, but I think legitimate way, insofar as church history tends to call into question for us or for other people, did Jesus really defeat sin and death here? Did he really rise from the dead? Is this really the turning point of history? That insofar as we look at church history and we see injustice or selfishness or the misuse of power or just the status quo being supported by people appealing to Jesus and religion, it really gives people cause to doubt whether this is Good Friday, whether this is really the turning point. And insofar as the church gives people doubt, it's almost always because we are choosing what we want over the purposes of God and the good of our neighbor when suffering versus satisfaction is the choice that is before us. And insofar as the church just continues to do that, it just makes it seem like nothing has changed. But the moments in church history, and I don't think they're rare. I don't think they're the only moments by any means. And I don't think the moments of hypocrisy are rare either. But I also think that so much of church history is precisely captivating and compelling because Christians have so often chosen to follow in Jesus's footsteps in living this way, starting hospitals, caring for the poor, caring for those who are sick, fighting injustice, dealing with what has gone wrong in the world in the same kind of way that Jesus did. Insofar as the church embodies that in the world, it actually begins to make sense of the claim that something decisively changed 2,000 years ago in the world. A different kind of being human in the world, a way of being human where sin and Satan are not the main realities, but where love for God and love for neighbor are, that was unleashed on the world through this moment. And it is something that still calls us to imitate and to follow. And so I think Simon of Cyrene is someone there exemplary for us. Simon of Cyrene, I think, is very much like Bartimaeus in the Gospel of Mark, very much like the poor widow, and very much like the woman who anoints Jesus with the costly perfume. He is a little snapshot of an ideal disciple. And it's because he's carrying the cross with and for Jesus in this moment. That happened literally, but I think Mark tells us that because that's part of the meaning of the cross. It's something that we are enlisted into, not something that we are only spared from, even though in another sense that is true. All right, last thing, and then we'll wrap up with just a couple of points of implication. The end of the story brings a new character, another new character in, the centurion. And at the end of this story, Mark 15, verses 33 to 39, that we're told Jesus, with the words of Psalm 22 on his lips, dies experiencing, and this is just what death is ultimately, theologically, experientially, abandoned, forsaken by God, and he breathes his last. We're told that both in verse 37, Jesus uttered a loud cry and he breathed his last. And then in verse 39, and when the centurion who stood facing Jesus saw that in this way he breathed his last, not just that he breathed his last, but that in this particular way, this is what death looked like for this man, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. And two things about that real quick. The first is that the word in Greek for breathed is the verb of spirit. Same word used for the Holy Spirit, that the ultimate gift that God gives all human beings, his own breath, his own spirit, his own life within us, is taken away at death. And that's coming for all of us in a fallen world, regardless. But the most valuable thing that anyone can ever do or give for another person is to lay down their life for them. If you were at any point in the near future on your deathbed and you knew that you had a week or a month to live, and if there was anything else in your existence, in your life that you could offer, if you had enough money in your bank account saved up, if you had enough military forces or political influence, if you had enough friends who owed you favors, if you had enough physicals around whatever, that you could say, I'll do this if you give me another 5 years, you would pay that price because nothing is more valuable than the breath of God that is within us. To be alive, that is the ultimate gift in creation that God has given us. And Jesus voluntarily gives it up for his friends and for his enemies. And as the centurion sees that in this way, he breathed his last, he says, whatever else we can say about this guy, truly he was the Son of God. Now, there's all kinds of debate over what could the centurion really know about Jesus? And what could he mean as probably a pagan Gentile by Son of God? He might just mean something like he was innocent, he was righteous, like he was virtuous. But certainly Mark wants us to hear that what he told us in literally verse 1 of chapter 1 of this book, this is the story of Jesus, the Son of God. What only God the Father has communicated at Jesus' baptism and at the transfiguration, behold, this is my Son. The centurion is the first human being in this story to get to recognize that this is the Son of God. And it's not accidental that is on the cross, that that's finally recognizable about Jesus. You can finally see that. So I want to suggest that through the lens of the centurion, here's another image for the cross, that it is the ultimate revelatory moment in human history. It is the ultimate moment of seeing clearly what God is like. That if you want to know what the wisdom of God really looks like, there is no moment in history that teaches us so clearly as this moment. If you really want to know what the love of God, the patience of God, the holiness of God, the anger of God against sin, the justice of God that opposes all that is evil, any attribute, characteristic of God you want to know, this is the moment when we see it most clearly. And I think you could even add to that, this is also the moment when you see most clearly what a human being was supposed to be like. Someone who to the utmost would give everything, no matter what the cost, for the glory of God and the good of their neighbors. This is the moment when we see that most fully. One of the 20th century archbishops of Canterbury was named Michael Ramsay, and riffing on a line in 1 John 1, where John says, in him, in God, there God is light, and in him there is no darkness, no darkness at all. He riffs on that, and he says this, and I always love this line. He says, God is Christ-like, and in God there is no un-Christ-likeness at all. That what he's saying is that in this moment, in the story of Jesus, we see more than we saw anywhere else, in Genesis, in Exodus, anywhere else in the Old Testament, anywhere else since then, we see a picture, a revelation of what God is like. That this crystallizes other things we knew about God, but more dimly or weren't even guessing. We see God revealed in his divinity. We see ideal humanity revealed. And the centurion reminds us that the cross is the vantage point from which we see what God is like and what human beings are supposed to be like more clearly than in any other moment in history. Any claims someone wants to make about God, Christians are always going to test, among other things, by holding them up to the cross. Any claims about what human beings are supposed to be like in the world, to be just or to be wise or to be good or to be whatever, to be religious, is going to be held up by Christians against the cross, because this is the ultimate revelation of that for us. So let me end with just maybe two implications. I really do think that one way you can connect the dots between these four metaphors, these four theories, these four paradigms or images for the cross, Pilate and his soldiers, Barabbas, Simon of Cyrene and the centurion, with Christus Victor, Christ triumphs over evil, sacrifice, Jesus substitutes himself for us for the forgiveness of our sins, a moral example of what it looks like to love God and to love our neighbor, even though we need to often suffer in a fallen world to do that, but in hope of vindication in the future, of coming life, that it's still a hopeful thing to love someone like that. And then finally, that this is the moment when God is revealed above all else, is what you kind of have is what did the cross accomplish? That sin and death and Satan were defeated. How did that happen? Through Jesus sacrificing himself for us. Why did he do that? So that he might be the beginning, the first fruits of a new humanity that also loves God and loves their neighbor like that in the world, and on whom he will pour out his spirit later on. And that's what church history is supposed to look like. And the moments we repent of are the moments that that's not what we're doing. And then ultimately, why does all of this happen? Or maybe a better way to put it is, who is doing all of this? And the cross reveals is the God who raised Jesus from the dead. This is what he is like. And so that's the first thing. It's just all of these ways are ways that we should think about the cross, that we should make sense of the claim that this is not just a Friday in history, but this is Good Friday. And the second thing is just very simple. As we get ready for Easter in the days to come, we're not quite there yet, but Easter shouldn't just be a one-day celebration and then we forget it and move on right after it. We've had 40 days of Lent, and Easter is the beginning of a season of celebration, a season of remembering that the victory's already been won, that the sacrifice has been made, that God has been revealed, that a new people have been formed to love God and love their neighbor. And I just want to encourage us, let's take time in the days and weeks to come to actually rejoice and hope and build our confidence on the most decisive event in the history of the universe. Was not the Enlightenment, and it was not the rise of the Industrial Revolution. It wasn't the founding of America or this in the 13th century, that it was the death and resurrection of Jesus 2000 years ago. That is the climax, the pinnacle, the hinge upon which the rest of the story is based on. Let's actually look at the world and respond to it as if this Friday really is Good Friday. Let's rejoice. Let's hope. Let's give thanks to God. Let's go out and love our neighbor in response to this. Let's be people who actually believe the good news that this story that Mark has told us claims to be. Let me pray for us.